So we're going to move on now, and I'll talk about multiple myeloma, and we're going to ask the same question to the myeloma people in terms of we asked ChatGPT what they thought the best paper of the year was in myeloma, and we'll see what you guys think compared to what ChatGPT thought. But I know also we have here, so we're going to start out here, and we have for our faculty, we have Dr. Hans Lee from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Dr. Nupur Rajay from the Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center in Boston, and Dr. Shakir Peles from the Lake Worth and the Florida Cancer Specialist. So as I was saying, faculty, we've been asking ChatGPT what they think the most important papers of the year were in all these cancers that we're talking about. I'm curious what your thoughts are. I'll start out with you, Nupur. I'll tell you that ChatGPT really liked the Majestic Tech-3 teclistamab DARA paper.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. That was one of the papers which came out last year in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it might be one of those which are going to be practice-changing, actually, and we will be talking about it during this module. So it was one of the best papers. We also had some really interesting presentations at ASH, which are not yet published, Neil, and those are exciting in terms of the T-cell engaging therapies in myeloma.
The ones we have or new ones?
New ones. The newer ones coming down the pike. We have some really interesting things coming down, like, you know, in vivo CARs, et cetera, which are amazing.
In vivo CARs. Yeah, that was interesting. Hans, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I agree. I think probably the most exciting paper in myeloma, but perhaps all of hematologic malignancies, was the Majestic 3 trial. Maybe biased because I'm focused on myeloma and we focus on myeloma. I would also mention that there is a nice paper of the combination of teclistamab and talquetamab in extramedullary disease that was also published in New England Journal of Medicine this year as well, which really showed high activity in difficult-to-treat EMD.
So we're going to go on and start to look at some of these key data sets. Also, one other thing I was going to bring up before you get started, in talking to your colleague down the road at Dana-Farber, Paul Richardson, he was telling me about the new determination trial. Determination 2, you may remember that was a plenary presentation at ASCO looking at transplant. And Nupur, I was just curious if you had any thoughts about what they're going to look at there, because interestingly, the base regimen they're going to look at, instead of DARA, they're going to look at isatuximab, and instead of lenalidomide, they're going to use iberdomide. They're just using it. It's not a comparison. They're just using it. And they're also bringing in linvoseltinib as a bispecific compared to transplant. So there's some pretty far-reaching parts of that trial. Curious what your thoughts are about it.
No, I think this is such an exciting time in myeloma, Neil, and I do think, you'll see my conclusion. Moving these immunotherapies early is what we should be doing. Hans is going to talk to us about CELMoDs. He's going to talk to us about iberdomide and mezigdomide. They are the more potent immunomodulatory drugs, so why not use our best treatment strategies up front? And, you know, we've just come back from a meeting in Miami where we actually have defined what cure in myeloma is going to look like. And unless we move these treatments up front, we're not going to be able to see that proportion of patients cured of this disease.
Shakir, any questions about this? I'm curious when your patients, you see a newly diagnosed patient and they ask what to expect from the future, do you bring up cure as a possibility?
That's a great question. I think I love myeloma. I think it's been exciting to be in the myeloma space for the last two decades, but maybe even more exciting now because of the possibility of cure. I usually tell a new patient that, you know, the average survival for myeloma right now is probably somewhere around 15 years, but that it's probably going to be better by the time they get to the 15-year mark, and that, you know, cure is on the horizon here, absolutely.
All right, well, let's get into some of the data. Nupur?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about CARs and bispecifics, and really here are my disclosures. And we're going to leave the ADC. We heard a lot about ADCs in the ovarian cancer session. We're going to leave that for Hans to talk about. And I'm going to focus on the bispecifics and the CAR T cells, which are the T cell redirecting treatments. So with that, you all know that we have two CARs already approved in the context of myeloma. We have Irisel and Ciltacel. Both of them are CARs which target a protein, a survival protein in myeloma called BCMA. They're quite similar except for the fact that Ciltacel has a biepitopic dual sort of epitope binding in the CAR construct. And what we have now is the FDA approval. The indications are a little bit different for Irisel. It's after two prior lines of treatment, so two lines of treatment, so at third relapse, you can actually get Irisel as long as you've had an IMiD, a PI, and an anti-CD38. Ciltacel is in an earlier line of treatment, so just after one prior line of treatment. And all of you saw this really exciting data at ASCO, where we have the updated PFS and overall survival. And this is where the birth of the cure definition actually came up, Neil. And this was patients who've been followed for a little over 5 years. You see that 33% of these patients are progression-free. And the other real important caveat here is that they are progression-free without being on any therapy, which is a new paradigm in multiple myeloma. So really exciting. And remember, the CARTITUDE 1 data was at the back end of myeloma. It was not moving treatment in the earlier lines, and this actually made it to the New York Times as well. So we have looked at long-term safety and really no new safety signals. One has to be careful about second cancers and infection risks seen with all T-cell engager treatments. So this is where the two CAR products have gotten approved. This was the KarMMa 3 trial. Important to highlight, very different patient population. These were 95% of these were daratumumab refractory patients, and more than 65% of these were triple class refractory. If you look at the data compared to standard of care, Irisel was clearly a lot better. The PFS was close to 14 months as opposed to 3 or 4 months, which is what is typically seen in patients who are daratumumab refractory, and we are seeing more and more of these patients at even first and second relapse. If you look at the CARTITUDE 4 data, a little bit different here. And the fact here is that just about 23% as opposed to 95% in the KarMMa 3 were daratumumab refractory. The triple class refractoriness is also a lot less here, is about 14%. Again, underscoring the fact that this is an earlier line of treatment. And with that, we are seeing amazing progression-free survivals as we move these CAR T-cell therapies early. So at 30%, nearly 60% of patients are remaining without evidence of progression, without being on any treatment. And if you look at the overall survival of these patients at about 33 months, 76% of these patients are continuing to be alive without being on any therapy. So really life-changing sort of treatments. But, you know, with CAR T-cells, there are certain barriers, obviously. And in 2026, it still remains a little bit logistically challenging. It has gotten a whole lot better, I will say, as we've moved these earlier. We are not waiting for them to have gone through multiple lines of treatment. It is an autologous product, so we have to have the patient go through the process of collection. It does require a little bit of a waiting period between the apheresis and actually giving back the CAR T cells. It takes us anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks to manufacture those T cells and give them back. And we also, as of right now, using lymphodepleting chemotherapy, although that's pretty well tolerated in most of these patients.
So I'm getting a little flashbacks here. I was thinking about when the CAR T first came out in myeloma. Initially, you were all real excited. And then everybody was very pessimistic. Everybody seemed to be relapsing. And it was like, no, this is just going to be another therapy. How do we go from there to talking about cure?
Yeah, so I'm still excited. I don't know who was not excited about CAR T cells.
There was a period there when it wasn't looking too good.
Yeah, so, you know, remember we used it first in patients who had absolutely no options of treatment, and to yet see 33% of those patients alive and well today is actually such a success story in my mind. And you're already seeing the CARTITUDE 4 data. As we move these treatments earlier, we're seeing 75% of these patients without evidence of disease and alive. So I do think we have trials in the upfront setting now, Neil. We're very excited about those. And it's not just these two CAR products. There are a whole bunch of other CAR products which we are not even talking about today, which we are super excited about. We have anito-cel, we have the AstraZeneca CAR T-cell, and we also have this new in vivo CAR T-cells, which looks pretty amazing.
So Hans, what we as Nupur was mentioning, we have two different products. Do you generally have access to either one, and which one do you prefer in which situations?
Yeah, I would say currently there's two FDA-approved products for CAR T and myeloma, ide-cel and cilta-cel. I think by and large, most of us are using cilta-cel in all comers just because it does seem to show increased efficacy compared to ide-cel in terms of longevity or durability of response. Although one potential patient population I might consider ide-cel is the older patient population. There might be less toxicity with ide-cel in that particular patient population. So if someone over the age of 80, maybe perhaps ide-cel could be a consideration.
Have you seen this sort of Parkinsonian syndrome that's been described with cilta-cel, and what happens?
So fortunately, in my personal patient, I have not. But certainly I've seen it sort of in patients I've treated with my colleagues. So certainly it's something that to be concerned of, you know, in a subset of patients.
So Shakar, in a second, I'm going to ask you if you have any questions for the faculty about CAR T. I was just flashing on the first time I ever worked with you in Nupur was at an ASH meeting like 100 years ago. And one of the speakers was sick, and all of a sudden we realized that we were going to finish 15 minutes early, and you were coming on as the last speaker, and we didn't know you at all. And they just said, well, start asking her questions. And the next thing we knew, it was like 20 minutes later, and we were like, oh, okay, we've discovered a star here. So how about in vivo CAR T? What is it?
So in vivo CAR T cell, the benefit of it clearly is you don't have to collect the cells, you don't have to manufacture cells, and we actually give the viral construct to the patient. So it's an off-the-shelf product, it's given intravenously, and this viral construct then goes and finds the T cells, it infects the T cells, makes the CAR inside the body, and those CARs do the job. So this was presented as a late-breaking abstract at this year's ASH meeting, and although they just had four patients, these were heavily pretreated four patients who had just gotten this one infusion of treatment, and with that, all these four patients went into an MRD negative complete response. So to me, that is absolutely, you know, I feel like we're living in a science fiction world right now, Neil, and the data looks pretty amazing. And obviously, we don't have the longer term follow up, but as of right now, we do know that this product, these patients who are in an MRD negative CR are continuing in an MRD negative CR for close to 9 to 12 months now.
So, Shakar, we're actually starting a program now where we're arranging for general medical oncologists in the community to go visit CAR T centers. I think we talked to both of you about that possibility, because I feel like maybe we don't have a good feel for what's actually going on when the patients get CAR T. Any questions you have in general about CAR T?
So many questions. So first off, you know, I'd like to know what you guys think about, you know, how do you decide which patient is appropriate for CAR T in the second line or the third line? I work in South Florida, much older patient population. What's the oldest patient you've sent for CAR T? Do you have concerns about not only toxicity, but the efficacy of CAR T in those older patients in terms of, you know, availability of T cells? And, you know, what can you tell me about allogeneic CAR T maybe in patients who've had multiple lines of therapy and are older, and you worry a bit about the CAR construct not being as effective?
Hans?
Yeah, you know, I would say that by and large, especially in my personal practice, I would refer a patient no later than third line therapy for a BCMA targeted therapy, including CAR T therapy. So I think no later than third line. And second line, I think it depends on the patient's personal preference and also their disease status as well. So a patient with high risk disease, functional high risk disease, those patients definitely would prioritize for second line CAR T. Standard risk myeloma, I think there's a discussion about patient preference. Some may prefer to do it second line or third line. So it's a bit of a nuanced conversation.
So we're going to move on to now. And actually, you know, this came up last night. We did a program on no follicular lymphoma, diffuse large B cell. And again, this issue of bispecific versus CAR T, which comes first. And we're about to get into it again. Nupur?
Yeah, so why drive a car when you can ride a bike? And all of us are going healthy, so I'm going to show you some data. And hopefully I'm going to argue that try the car before the bike, though. All right, so we have a bunch of BCMA bispecific T-cell engagers in the context of myeloma. These are all approved. We have teclistamab and linvoseltamab, and we have elranatamab. All of them target the same protein that the CAR T-cells target, so it is the B-cell maturation antigen. Slight differences in the IgG FC region, but really quite similar otherwise. And these are sort of the pivotal trials which have gotten all of these approved. We have the Magnetism 3 trial, the Majestic 1 trial, and the Linker MM1 trial, and all of them were used as monotherapy. All of them were used in the back end of myeloma, that is relapse refractory myeloma, and based on the response rates and the durability of response, all of these have gotten approved. And if you really look at all of the bispecifics here, and that's sort of highlighted. You have elranatamab, linvoseltamab, we'll leave talquetamab for a little bit later. It's a different target, but teclistamab, you see that the overall response rates of all of this is about anywhere between 60 and 70%, and the durability of responses with all of this is a little over a year, and depending on when the drug product was developed, you keep getting a little bit better with a PFS of elranatamab around 18 months, and linvoseltamab is close to 24 months or so. This is the data with all of the BCMA bispecific T-cell antibodies. I think the biggest concern used to be the cytokine release syndrome as well as ICANS. We really don't see a lot of neurotoxicity with any of the bispecifics that we are using. CRS is seen. Most of this cytokine release syndrome is grade 2, and it's quite easy to manage, and we can talk about that. In terms of which one is better than the other, in my opinion, they're pretty comparable. Response rates, I've already told you, 60 to 70%, and the PFS is in excess of about 12 months. And as we've developed these, I think we've gotten better with our supportive care strategies, and with that, the PFS seems to have improved as well. Now, all of them have a step-up dosing schedule, and there's slight subtle differences between all of them, and this is sort of highlighted in this table. You have teclistamab, elranatamab, and linvoseltamab. You know, and really it depends on which bispecific you have available at your site. Places like ours, we actually have all three available. That's because we end up doing the step-up dosing, and depending on who we are sending the patient back to, we check in with them and see what they have available on their formulary. I think this is important to sort of highlight here. The one thing which I like to look at is the dosing. So for example, if you look at the dosing of teclistamab on day one, it's a really, really, really whiff of a dose, 0.06 mg per kg. And then it goes to 0.3 mg. And it's day seven that you're seeing the higher dose. Why is it important? It's important to predict when are these patients going to get their CRS. With elranatamab, it's 12 milligrams and 32 milligrams, so we end up seeing CRS around there, even with the first dose, but sometimes with the second dose. With tech, it's usually with the day seven that you're seeing the CRS. And with linvoseltamab, the dosing is very different. It's day 1, 8, and 15, and they require just 24 hours of hospitalization with this. But at least the label suggests that the hospitalization is preferred. It is not mandated, and all of us at our centers are using protocols to try and make this by a procedure in the outpatient setting. And I think what's made that a lot easier is the use of tocilizumab. So tocilizumab is an IL-6 receptor antibody, and it can be used to prophylax against even that little bit of CRS that you see with this, and this has now made it into the NCCN guidelines, so most of us can use it, and at least at centers like ours at Mass General, we have what we call the BOSS program. I have Diana Kirstia from my group who's leading this effort where we're using bispecific outpatient safe step-up dosing, and here we're not even using prophylactic tocilizumab. We're only using prophylactic dexamethasone. It's only used during that first week of the step-up dosing, and here you see data. And what you see in the orange bars is the inpatient step-up dosing, and the blue bars is the outpatient. And by using the dexamethasone outpatient, we've been able to reduce the risk of CRS very substantially. And about 10% of patients who started out in the outpatient required hospitalization, but the hospitalization, as opposed to the 5 to 8 days that we typically use in these cases, was between 1 and 2 days. So we've cut back on that hospitalization. We've been able to safely give this even without tocilizumab. And now with tocilizumab, we hardly ever admit any of these patients. This is just a table sort of comparing all of these. You have CAR T cells and you have bispecifics. And the question is, what do we use? I'm going to leave the ADC discussion for later on. I think the big thing with the CAR T cells is the response rates are a lot higher. The durability is a lot longer, and it's a one and done treatment. Obviously, the caveats there is it's not off the shelf. You have to be able to go to a center to get it, and you have to go through the whole apheresis protocol. There is some data, though, not great data, but this is data to kind of help us with the sequencing question. What should I use first? And at least it gives us a hint. I do think this is going to change over time. And what you see out here is this is CARTITUDE 2. It was a cohort of patients who were treated after they'd had a prior BCMA. And what you see out here is if you save the CAR T cells for after you've had either an ADC or you've had a bispecific, the data looks actually pretty bad. The PFS of these patients is around 6 months or so. So if you are thinking about doing a CAR T cell, do not give them a bispecific. I think that's the learning from this. The same data was shown with Ide-cel as well. The PFS with Ide-cel was even shorter. It was about 3 months, and it didn't matter whether you had an ADC or the bispecific. You do interfere with the antigen. And with the, there is some data the other way around. So you've had a CAR T cell, and then you get a bispecific. And if you look at some of the data with elranatamab, for example, sure, the response rates go down a little bit, but those response rates going down, still you see instead of 60%, you're seeing 40 to 50% of patients responding. So doing it the other way around would be the suggestion. I will say that this is really biased data because we are probably picking the worst of the worst patients. And as of right now, we are giving bispecifics continuously. And going forward, if we start moving them earlier, we're going to go to fixed duration. And this sequencing question hopefully will become less of an issue. Now, we talked a lot about the Majestic 3 data, and you're absolutely right, Neil. The data looks fantastic. This is the Majestic 3 overall survival, 83% at 3 years. And I've just put the, you shouldn't compare and contrast this way, but I put this up because this is in that same space. So you have CARTITUDE 4, you have Majestic 3, and the data of Majestic 3 actually looks even better. So what do you pick? Hopefully, I've shown you some of the sequencing data, and most those of us who do CAR T cells, we would still prefer to do the CAR T cell before giving the Tec-Dara combination, but certainly an option, and certainly an option to discuss with your patients going forward. Quick word on some of the other bispecifics. This is the Monumental trial. This is with talquetamab. The target for talquetamab is GPCR5D. They've tried two different dose levels. And what you see out here is, again, a response rate, which is very similar to what you saw with the BCMA-directed bispecifics, about 70% or so. The efficacy, again, overall response rates is about 70% with the median PFS of about 12 months or so, and they've done it Q-weekly, Q2-weekly. I think the biggest challenge with the talquetamab is the associated toxicities, and these are very patient-facing toxicities. You see dysgeusia, significant weight loss. You see skin and nail changes, and a patient really feels all of this, and it's really tough to manage this, and we can talk about that during our discussion going forward. So I do think we have a lot of different options, and there are a few challenges. I think moving therapy early will impact what we use later on, but the hope is that we keep getting bigger and better drugs in this space of myeloma. Sequencing is a question and needs to be addressed more systematically. We are already using bispecifics in the maintenance state, and stay tuned. You will hear about some of the maintenance studies at ASCO and EHA as well as ASH. And with early, are we ready to say no more one and done, or is there a subset of patients where we would want to maintain? And we are using combinations. These are some of the trials we're doing at Mass General, where we are combining the bispecifics with some of the new cell mods, and the data there also looks really very promising. For the future, I'm super excited. I think we have to use fixed duration with all of these treatments, even with the bispecifics, and we have a great surrogate in myeloma, which is minimal residual disease testing. We will be combining immunotherapy. So rather than pitch the CARs against the bispecifics, we are doing trials at MGH. The determination trial 2 that you talked about is combining some of these approaches. And my hope is that we combine all of these very successful treatments, and total immunotherapy is what is going to get us to that, transforming this chronicity of myeloma into a curable state of myeloma. So with that, I think we're done.
Total immunotherapy, that's a good one. I like that. And a second, we'll go to Shocker, see if he has any questions. But Hans, a couple of questions. Incidentally, last night, you were bringing a preemptive TOSI to the lymphoma people. Go, well, we don't do it. And we're like, well, the myeloma people do it all the time. How come you're not doing it? But anyhow, I'm curious about how you choose between bispecifics. So Hans, and also Nupa was talking about talquetamab. You know, you hear about these tolerability issues, but in your own experience, like, what's quality of life really like with these patients?
Yeah, in terms of choosing between BCMA bispecifics, we have 3 that are FDA approved: elranatamab, teclistamab, linvoseltamab. All are very effective. I think the take-home message is this can be done in the community oncology setting. So, you know, we saw the fantastic data with Majestic 3. I think that sort of compels us that we have to get this to our patients, and whatever modality to get you there, prophylactic TOSI, prophylactic dexamethasone, we can really mitigate the risk for CRS quite significantly to get patients dosed where they're at.
And then again, talquetamab, what's life like on it?
Yeah, so talquetamab definitely has a unique side effect profile: the dysgeusia, the taste changes, skin changes, nail brittleness. I would say that it's a very effective drug. I think the important thing is how you dose it. So you go hard early on, and then they respond pretty quick, patients within 1 or 2 months, then quick to back off. So, you know, decrease the frequency of dosing, decreasing the dose itself, and this can mitigate the toxicity long-term, particularly in patients without other great treatment options.
So, Shocker, any questions?
So to drill it down into the prophylactic TOSI question, is that something you would give to every patient getting a bispecific? Do you select certain patients? Do you only give it to high-risk patients? Do you still admit them to the hospital if they get prophylactic TOSI? Or do you feel comfortable managing them as an outpatient if they got that new prophylactic dose?
Yeah, so, you know, we use TOSI selectively. We don't use it in everybody. Patients with the high disease burden going in, I will give them tocilizumab. Once you give them tocilizumab, you really don't have to hospitalize them at all. When we started the BOS protocol, we weren't using TOSI, but now even that 10% is not being hospitalized anymore.
All right, let's move on now, get into ADCs. Hans.
Great, thanks, Neil. So these are my disclosures. So in this part of the session, I'm going to be basically talking about two modalities of therapy, antibody-drug conjugates, namely belantamab mafodotin, which was recently FDA-approved in combination of bortezomib and dexamethasone last October, and a new emerging class of therapies called CELMoDs, which will hopefully get FDA-approved in the near future. So many of you are familiar with belantamab mafodotin. It's a BCMA antibody-drug conjugate. The antibody portion binds to BCMA on the plasma cell. It's conjugated via non-cleavable linker to monomethyl auristatin F. It has multiple mechanism action, the ADC mechanism, which actually delivers a chemomoiety to the myeloma cell, ADCC, ADCP. And I think something that's probably most interesting is this phenomenon called immunogenic cell death. So it actually triggers an adaptive immune response, hopefully leading to long-term durable immunity against the tumor. And so, as I mentioned earlier, belantamab, bortezomib, dexamethasone was recently FDA-approved last year based on the pivotal DREAM-7 study. This is a randomized phase 3 trial that enrolled patients with at least one prior line of therapy. Randomized patients either received belimumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone, or daratumumab, bortezomib, dexamethasone. So essentially, it's a head-to-head trial between dara and belimumab. And patients then continued on belimumab monotherapy or daratumumab monotherapy after 8 initial cycles, primary endpoint being PFS. The baseline patient characteristics, I did want to just highlight that this was a less heavily pretreated patient population. About a third of patients were refractory to lenalidomide, very little prior daratumumab exposure. And when looking at sort of the top-line results of the DREAM-7 study, they're quite impressive. So the study did meet its primary endpoint of both PFS, and also there's an overall survival benefit. And not only was there a PFS benefit, but a near tripling of progression-free survival benefit with bela bortezomib dexamethasone versus daratumumab bortezomib dexamethasone. And this, as I mentioned earlier, led to the approval of belantamab mafodotin plus bortezomib dexamethasone, at least two prior lines of therapy in the United States in October of 2025. In terms of additional post-hoc analyses of the DREAM-7 study, I think what was also very interesting presented at this recent ASH meeting in December of 2025 was the MRD and depth of response data. And so we all know that MRD is now emerging as a very, very important response measurement, a prognostic marker in multiple myeloma. It's a surrogate endpoint, essentially, for potential regulatory approval now. And so the combination of belantamab mafodotin plus bortezomib dexamethasone led to greater than twofold higher MRD negative rates compared to daratumumab bortezomib dexamethasone. I did also want to mention the DREAM-8 study. So this is another randomized phase 3 trial evaluating belantamab mafodotin plus pomalidomide dexamethasone versus pomalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone. Again, enrolling an earlier relapsed refractory myeloma patient population, at least one prior line of therapy. I did want to mention that in this particular group of patients, they were a little bit more heavily pretreated than the DREAM-7 patient population. Over 3/4 of patients were lenalidomide refractory. About a quarter of patients were anti-CD38 refractory in this particular study. And this study also met its primary endpoint. There's a significant improvement of progression-free survival, again, a near tripling of PFS benefit with belimumab pomalidomide dexamethasone versus pomalidomide bortezomib dexamethasone. And there's a trend towards overall survival benefit, although this did not meet statistical significance. And ultimately, this led to the approval of belantamab mafodotin plus pomalidomide dexamethasone in Europe in a patient at least one prior line of therapy. Hopefully, this will get approved down the road in the U.S. in the near future. So we know that one of the unique side effects of belimumab is this ocular toxicity. I think many of us are familiar with this in the room. And basically, there's really two components of this. It can lead to keratopathy or inflammation of the cornea, and changes in best-corrected visual acuity, or BCVA. And so there was this grading scale developed for the belimumab clinical trials called the KVA scale, which really separated the corneal exam findings and the BCVA, and you can see based on severity, grade 1 through grade 4. And so in the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8 studies, ocular adverse events were common. Although I do want to mention that the majority of these events resolve. So with time off therapy or dose delays, these do tend to resolve. Typically speaking, when it said there was no resolution, it's basically there was a data cutoff and there was actually no documented sort of resolution in that regards. But in clinical practice, I think we can all agree that majority of these ocular events do resolve. I do also want to mention that even when there's keratopathy seen on the ocular exam by the ophthalmologist, a lot of times this is subclinical. So again, even with grade 2 keratopathy, there actually may be minimal visual acuity changes. So I did want to mention that sometimes the keratopathy precedes the BCVA changes. And so in the Belimumab clinical trial programs, the primary mechanism to manage these ocular adverse events is dose delays and dose reduction. So again, ocular events, adverse events were common in the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8 studies. Over 90% of patients, although who did have dose reductions and dose delays, actually had continued response or deepening of response despite dose delays lasting at least 9 weeks. So again, it doesn't seem to adversely affect the response or the duration of response by dose delaying or dose reducing Belimumab. So I think that's really, really important as we apply this in routine clinical practice. And so this slide basically highlights the dose modification guidance in both the DREAM-7 and DREAM-8 studies. So again, the primary mechanism being dose delay and dose reduction. I would say that my advice in routine clinical practice is that when I give Belimumab, you know, I give it standard dose, either 2.5 or even 1.9 milligrams per kilogram, and patients tend to respond pretty quickly, especially when you give it in combination with either pomalidomide dexamethasone or bortezomib dexamethasone, and pretty quick to back off. So either reduce the dose, if you're at 2.5, go down to 1.9, spread out the dose to every 8 to every 12 weeks. As I mentioned from the previous slide, patients tend to respond and maintain their response despite the dose delays and dose reduction. So I think this really, really can mitigate the ocular toxicity. And so again, Belimumab is a quite well-tolerated drug. There's no steroids. There's no sort of weird other immune-related side effects besides the keratopathy. And so again, if you really are aggressive and dose-modifying, it's actually quite a well-tolerated drug. And I did want to mention that there's emerging data in newly diagnosed patients. So actually, the title of the slide is incorrect. It's not the DREAM-9 study. It's actually, that's a different newly diagnosed transplant-ineligible study. But nevertheless, the data here shows that the overall response rate in this particular trial with Belimumab, Len-Dex, and newly diagnosed transplant-ineligible myeloma showed overall response rate of over 90%. I did want to highlight in this particular study done by the Greek myeloma group that the dosing of Belimumab in the recommended phase 2 dose was actually spread out. It's 1.9 milligrams per kilogram every 8 weeks. And we saw quite durable responses from this study, as well as mitigation of some of the ocular adverse events with the lower starting dose and the more spread out dosing. And so this has now led to the rationale of this ongoing DREAM-10 study. So this was actually a randomized phase 3 study of Belimumab Len-Dex versus standard of care daratumumab, lenalidomide dexamethasone, and newly diagnosed transplant-ineligible myeloma patients. Again, I want to highlight the different dosing of Belimumab. So Belimumab is given at a lower dose, 1.9 milligrams per kilogram every 8 weeks for 24 weeks. Then it's even decreased further to every 12 weeks thereafter. So I think this approach, I think, is really the path forward for Belimumab moving forward. Again, really reduces the ocular toxicity and makes the patient experience better. And this is currently enrolled in the United States. There's actually sites open in Florida. So if you have any patients eligible for this study, then can look for sites in Florida enrolling to this particular study.
So before
yes,
we go
FCS,
on.
Yes, FCS.
So before we go on, Newport, I remember that about the time that Belimumab was pulled off the market, I was doing a video with a patient who had been on it for 4 years. And we were all so uncomfortable when it wasn't approved. We heard about these responses. We polled investigators when it wasn't approved and said, how many patients do you have in your practice right now where you'd like to use Belimumab? And the average was like about 5 at least. So thankfully, it was approved. ASCO, I see 4 big orals coming up. You mentioned DREAM 9 and 10, they're being presented, or 8 and 9 is being presented, the Bella DRD study. So much coming out here right now. And I guess the question is, like, where is it right now? Where are you using Belimumab? Are you using it alone or in combination?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously the fact that it's approved is a great option for our patients. You know, in the United States, I think with the ocular toxicity, which is again a very patient-facing toxicity, it's hard, although these studies are being done in the upfront setting, it would be hard to justify using Belimumab upfront. To me, what's most exciting about the DREAMM-7 data is for the first time you have an anti-CD38 against an anti-BCMA, and you're actually showing an overall survival benefit, suggesting that the BCMA target is a really good target. There's a lot of data which is coming out in the upfront setting with the bispecifics and combinations with lenalidomide, and obviously there's a little bit of difficulty in the step-up dosing, etc., but the response rates there are going to be a lot better without this ocular toxicity. So at least in the United States, I think where Belimumab is probably going to fit in is in the relapse refractory setting. We are using it in combination, and we are using it where either giving it every 8 to 12 weeks, and typically my dosing for Belimumab is 1.9, and that tends to be better tolerated.
So Hans, second opinion here. I'm kind of surprised that Newport is not too excited about Belimumab up front. To me, the ocular issue, you ought to be able to really not make it a big deal, I don't think. That's what I'm hearing. You tell me, do you agree, or do you see a future for it in the first line?
Yeah, you know, I think that the DREAMM-10 study is a very interesting study.
I mean, it beat
Dara.
Because,
yeah, and so I think, you know, keep in mind that in DREAMM-7, there's a nearly tripling of PFS benefit of Belimumab over Dara. So we'd expect potentially DREAMM-10 to be a positive study. So I think the big picture is that this really just improves the repertoire of good effective therapies for our patients. So again, one size doesn't fit all for our patients. There are some patients that might not be candidates for upfront CAR-T or even bispecific. And I think in this particular context, this provides a really highly effective therapy, potentially, hopefully, if DREAMM-10 is a positive study for patients and newly diagnosed.
So back to the real world. Shocker, I'm listening to all this. I'm trying to figure out what we do about it. Any questions?
What do you tell your patients when you're about to start this agent in terms of ocular toxicity? You know, I feel like I say to somebody, you might get neutropenic and die from sepsis. They say, that sounds bad. I say, you might lose your vision. They say, forget about it. I'm not taking that drug. You know, so how do you present it to the patient?
And Hans, really, again, I mean, I just want to know the truth. To me, what I'm hearing is it's not a huge issue practically, but is it?
Yeah, I mean, so if you're on Belimumab long enough, you will have
ocular toxicity. You're not going to lose your vision. You're
right.
Not going to become blind.
Right. I mean, you will have some form of ocular toxicity if you're on Belimumab long enough. But I would say in terms of vision loss, significant vision loss is rare. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the key is how you dose it. And again, this is not giving the label. This is actually why these programs exist, is that really when you dose Belimumab, again, start at a lower dose, either 1.9 or spread out the dose every 8 weeks, every 12 weeks. And that approach can really minimize the toxicity to much lower levels. So again, we're recommending, you know, a lower dose, less frequent dosing. It's not necessarily in the label, but practically speaking, that's the way to do it.
All right, well, let's continue here, and I want to hear a little bit about CELMoDs. Again, I see iberdomab is going to be used in the determination study instead of lenalidomide. I guess the hope will be less or no second cancers, better tolerability.
Yeah, so there's lots of exciting upcoming data with CELMoDs, with iberdomide and mezigdomide. So iberdomide and mezigdomide are in this class of drug called cereblon E3 ligase modulator. So essentially, iberdomide and mezigdomide bind to cereblon, which is part of the E3 ubiquitin ligase complex with a very, very high affinity, much higher affinity than lenalidomide and pomalidomide. And essentially, it triggers degradation of very, very important proteins like Ikaros and Aiolos that are important for the growth of plasma cells. So essentially, they're much more potent than lenalidomide and pomalidomide in terms of their mechanism of action. And so iberdomide has been studied in several different clinical trials. This particular trial was iberdomide plus dexamethasone in late relapse refractory multiple myelosis. Was published a couple years ago in Lancet Hematology. And so at the recommended phase 2 dose, a little over 100 patients, over response rate was 26%, median PFS of 3 months. This ultimately led to the Excalibur relapse refractory multiple myeloma trial. This is a randomized phase 3 trial of iberdomide, daratumumab dexamethasone versus daratumumab bortezomib dexamethasone. And basically, there was a press release actually last September, which did show that the study did meet its primary endpoint of MRD negative negativity rates compared to DVD. And so currently, FDA is reviewing iberdomide in this context, and hopefully will get approved later this year. PDUFA date's August of 2026. And then I did want to mention some data on mezigdomide. So mezigdomide is another CELMoD. This was also studied in late relapse refractory multiple myeloma in combination with dexamethasone. Over response rate in triple class refractory myeloma patients, 41%, median PFS of a little over 4 months. And this is being studied in several randomized phase 3 trials, notably the Successor 2 study is mezigdomide carfilzomib dexamethasone versus carfilzomib dexamethasone in patients at least one prior line of therapy. And this was also was mentioned in a press release actually last month that there was a significant improvement to PFS of mezi-KD versus KD. And this will actually be a late-breaking abstract presented at this year's ASCO meeting by Paul Richardson next month. So really, in summary, you know, we talked about belimumab in combination with bortezomib dexamethasone, now approved by the FDA as of October 2025 in patients at least two prior lines of therapy. Just really want to highlight that it's an effective drug, head-to-head compared to DARE2, and nearly a tripling of improvement to PFS. And the ocular adverse events, if I can really emphasize again, is really about dosing strategy. Dose reduce, dose delay the dose as needed, reduce the frequency, or again, really mitigate some of the ocular toxicity. And the oral CELMoDs, mezigdomide, iberdomide, just around the corner, good data so far in the randomized phase 3 trials. Hopefully we'll get FDA approved soon based on these studies.
So, Shocker, any questions about CELMoDs? How much of an issue or problem is lenalidomide in using it in myeloma patients? You know, do you think it really is going to make a difference to the patient to have these agents maybe better tolerated?
Yeah, I think we've become, you know, very experienced to managing lenalidomide and some of its related toxicities. You know, my question is, do we think these CELMoDs are going to displace lenalidomide and pomalidomide? You know, and I'll expand on that, especially with those drugs becoming generic. Is the degree of benefit worth it, or are we going to get pushback from payers, like in the CML space when imatinib became generic? You know, we were asked to use that agent.
Nupur?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And, you know, for that same reason, IBER doesn't have a registration trial in the upfront setting, right? All of those trials which are happening are investigator-initiated trials, and BMS is allowing them to see where sort of the chips fall. I do think there is a maintenance trial, iberdomide compared to lenalidomide, and we'll have to see how much better. You are 100% right. We've been using lenalidomide for 20 years. We are so used to the toxicity. Iber in general is extremely well tolerated. Mezi, on the other hand, requires a lot of dose reductions because it does cause a lot of myelosuppression. And especially when we start combining all of these drugs with some of what we have, I think in the upfront setting, probably a hard, difficult to come up with using all of these. But in the relapse setting, for example, the Successor 2 trial with KD, with Mezi, in the high-risk patients, we are going to need new options. But the upfront setting, I think it's an open area.
So myeloma, to me, has always been an area where you really, if possible, try to involve the patient in the decisions, because it's so much there's so many options. There always have been, and now they're even increasing. Thank you so much. We're going to move on.